Hello, this is Chris Long with the fifth episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. John Pulla is trying to solve the death of his aunt. He really believes that it could have been a murder. In the meantime, the man that was on the white slave boat is now on the beach and he's seeing another boat come in. The boat would not come all the way into shore. Of that he was certain. They would offload onto a smaller, more versatile platform for the final approach. He turned his attention to the road behind him as he crouched farther down in the native foliage that grew next to the dune. He heard the application of brakes and then doors opening and clunking closed. An overhead door was pulled up. He crouched still lower, moved to his left, and then lay flat in the sand as he eyed the large box truck and two SUVs that were parked on a small section of asphalt off the roadway. Three men stood next to the truck, its rear door open. Two other men were striding down the path leading to the beach. He assumed they were armed and prepared to use their weapons. He followed their movements down to the edge of the water. One of the men signaled with a flashlight. A return signal could be seen from farther out on the water. A few minutes passed, and then the sound of a small boat engine could be heard. As it drew closer to shore, the outline of the vessel became clearer. It was a 30-foot-long RIB, or rigid hull inflatable boat, which military special forces often used during their missions. It was painted black and was nearly invisible as it made its approach. It came to within several feet of the beach, and the pilot cut the engine, allowing the RIB to gently glide until the bow hit the sand. The men on the beach hustled forward and started grabbing people off the RIB, one by one, until 20 were assembled on the beach. They were tied together, and their mouths were taped shut. Even from this distance, he could see that many of them were children. Some had on blue shirts, some red, some green. This was not by accident. The colors designated the purpose and ultimate destination of the prisoners. There were more green shirts than the others. He was privy to the meanings the colors represented. Thus, he was not surprised by this. The choice of green had not been by happenstance either. To be sure, there was strong cash flow in blue and red, but green was where the real money was. Two of the men on the beach took the line of captives and led them up the boardwalk where they were quickly loaded into the box truck. The RIB's pilot put his boat in reverse and pulled away from the beach, then turned and headed back out to sea. At the same time, another RIB pulled in, cut the engine, drifted to shore, and the same transfer of captives took place. This happened twice more after the other two RIBs departed and the last group of captives was herded into the truck. The rear door was closed and locked. The men jumped into the cab and the box truck pulled away with the SUVs following. He sat alone on the beach watching the vehicles for a few seconds until they disappeared into the darkness heading west. Then he looked out to sea. He could barely hear the whine of the last RIB a few seconds later. It was gone, too. He counted in his head, four boats with a total of 80 captives. The entire transfer had taken less than 10 minutes. 10 minutes for 80 human beings to be pushed from point A to point B. 40 green, the rest split roughly equally between red and blue. He had just seen potentially millions of dollars of illegal commerce march across those sands. He had no idea where the truck was taking them. He knew that the RIBs would go back to the larger ship, lurking out there like some great white shark. He'd be loaded on, and then the ship would power its way back to the base. Tomorrow night, the process would likely start all over again. This was a business, after all, a big one, and like most businesses, the primary motivation was profit. And to be profitable, you had to sell product as quickly and efficiently as possible. Getting good prices and thereby keeping happy customers, the purposes for which the prisoners were being used were all insidious. But the fact was that much of the world simply didn't care enough to do anything about it. Well, he wasn't much of the world. He was simply one man, and he did care. Tonight had been merely a scheduled run for the cellars of human beings. For him, it had been a dry run to learn valuable intelligence. Soon there would come a time when the valuable intelligence would be translated into action. He wished it could have been tonight, but that most likely would have ended up with him killing all of the guards, freeing the captives, but destroying any chance he had of achieving his larger goal, or else with his being gunned down and thrown into the ocean. He walked a mile down the beach, retrieved his scooter, and headed back to the Sierra. He would sleep for a bit, but he doubted his sleep would be restful. He would keep the images of the captives in his thoughts for tonight and then for far longer. They deserved to have someone care about them. He did care, but he wanted to do more than care. He wanted to stop it. He wanted to stop it all. But most of all, he wanted to find someone. Chapter 31. Puller did not enter the Sierra through the front or back door. He hustled up the fire escape and made his way down from the roof via an access doorway used in part for maintenance of the HVAC system housed on top of the building. He had scoped out this detail earlier. He liked multiple entry and exit points from every place he occupied. Three floors down, he stepped out and onto the third floor. The hall was dark and unoccupied. One overhead light flickered and pulsed like erratic arcs of lightning. But that was all. Puller's room was the next to the last one on the left around the corner. He crouched in the darkness, but he also had a distinct advantage. Night vision goggles he bought from a store in downtown Paradise that sold police-level gear. They certainly weren't the best night optics he'd ever used, but they were serviceable. He slipped them down over his eyes, and dark turned to light as fuzzy details were transformed into high def. He figured they would be converging on their target about now. 6-on-1, overwhelming force, or so they thought. Puller was a first-rate, superbly trained close-quarters fighter, but he was not Superman. This was not a movie where he could matrix his way to victory. It would be fearful men fighting, making mistakes, but certainly landing some blows. Puller tipped the scales at well over 200 pounds. The men he would be facing tonight collectively weighed about 1,000 pounds. They had 12 fists and a dozen legs to his 2 and 2. 6 against 1, hand to hand, no matter how good you were or how inept the 6 were, would likely result in defeat. Puller could take out 3 or 4 rather quickly, but the remaining 2 or 3 men would probably get in a lucky shot and possibly knock him down, and then it would be over. Bats and bars would rain down on him, and then a gunshot would end it all. If one had a choice, and sometimes one did, a truly superb close-quarters fighter only fought when the conditions favored him. He didn't have much time, because they would quickly determine that he was not in the room. Then they would do one of two things, leave and come back, or set a trap and wait for him. And a trap would involve a perimeter. At least he was counting on that, because a perimeter meant that the 6 men would have to divide their forces. Then 6 became 4, or 3, 2, or even 1. Divide and conquer. That was the condition on the ground that Puller needed in order to win, and it would be even better if his adversaries tonight provided it for him. Something told him they would. A well-thought-out perimeter could defeat most plans to pierce it. A few moments later, he could see that this perimeter was not well thought out, and so it would be pierced rather easily. The 2 men were standing in the middle of the hall. They had taken no measures to conceal their presence. One had a bat, the other a gun. They were talking in low tones, looking smug, confident. The man holding the bat spun it like a baton. The man with the gun held it loosely, pointing down. 4 fingers were clasped around the butt of the weapon, his index finger not even near the trigger guard. In other words, the weapons were useless. The men didn't react until the bat was taken from the first man. A blow to his stomach from the head of the bat sent him pitching to the floor. The second man raised his gun, but did not fire it because he was no longer holding it. Puller, holding the pistol by the muzzle, brought the butt of the weapon around and crushed it against the man's temple. He went down to join his buddy on the ragged carpet covered in puke stains. A tap from the bat on the Writhing First Man's head was all that was needed to stop the writhing. The attack had taken all of 5 seconds. Puller had swung the bat at almost the same time he had stripped the gun from the other man. The only sounds that came from the bodies falling to the floor. Puller crouched there, the bat in one hand, his other hand around his M11. He had dropped the other pistol after removing the mag and clearing the chamber of the loaded round. He did not like firing other people's weapons. A badly maintained gun could be more dangerous to the one firing it than to the one being fired on. He counted off a few seconds in his head. 2 down, 4 to go. His room was around the corner. These jackasses had been the front line. He figured perhaps one man at another barrier, then 3 at ground zero to finish the job. He crab-walked to the corner, did a turkey peek, and drew back. Here the darkness was near total because someone had removed the overhead lights. Nice tactic, he thought, but with his goggles, darkness was preferable. Halfway down the hall, in a shadow that was deeper than the surrounding darkness, was stationed the third man. He was crouched in a narrow alcove. Gun, bat, or metal bar would be his weapon. Puller had several options. He could bull rush and reach the man before he could react, or he could approach with stealth, take the man down quietly, and move on. He opted for the latter. Slithering on his belly like he had through Florida swamps and Iraqi sands in his career as a ranger, Puller moved forward. He knew the crouching man would be looking at a point parallel to his eye level and then upward. It was just human nature. Only trained personnel would finish off the imaginary vertical line from floor to ceiling, knowing full well that an experienced attacker could come at you from virtually any angle, and the most obvious angle was never the most popular. He drew within a foot of the other man. Puller was looking up, the other man still swiveling his gaze in an uneven arc. When he looked away from Puller, the bat came up and the man went down, blood running from his head. The scalp bled like a bitch, and the accompanying headache when the man awoke would be one he would never forget. He had not hit any of the 3 men tonight hard enough to kill them. Puller knew how much force was required to crack skulls. He had not minded applying that force to men who raped women in front of their little brothers. But these men tonight were just the revenge crew. They might actually be as bad or worse than the ones Puller had already beaten up, but he would cut them a little slack. They would live to spread the message that to leave him alone was the smart money. This man had held the metal bar. Puller retrieved it and kept going. 3 down and 3 to go. The odds were much better. In fact, they had returned to the same ones he had dealt with in the stairwell, and the 3 men he had disabled were the members of the revenge crew, which meant the men up ahead were the rapist crew, the same ones who had no doubt come back and beaten up Isabel and little Mateo. Puller decided to up the level of force he was about to bring. He moved quickly down the hall. The door to his room was slightly ajar. He shook his head at the tactics employed by the opposition. A partially open door was like waving a red flag and screaming, "We're in here waiting for you," so you wouldn't go in. You would move to the room next door and try to surprise them through the connecting portal. But of course the surprise would be all yours as they blew you away. He envisioned them grouped around the connecting door, but he doubted their attention would be all that focused. For Puller to get that far, their perimeter would have to have been defeated almost soundlessly. They would imagine this could never happen. They had chosen to be the rearguard tonight because they had hoped that Puller would never make it this far. They did not want another encounter with him. What sane person would after the beating they had endured? For all he knew, they would be playing cards or banging back beers to get up their courage, or smoking cigarettes or peering out the lone window, anything but being professional. He hit the door to his room so hard that it broke off the hinges. There were 2 shapes directly in front of him. As he had thought, they were clustered around the connecting door. The metal bar took out both with one swing. White dropped onto the bed. This time he might very well be dead. Black was flung through the window, shattering the glass, and dangled there, half in, half out. Now Latino was the only one left. He was in the far corner of the room, looking ready to crap his pants. He had his gun out. He was at most 6 feet from Puller. In the dark, and with his adrenaline spiking and turning fine motor skills to zero, it might as well have been 6 miles. He fired once and missed by 5 feet. He did not get a chance to fire a second time. The first blow knocked the gun from his hand. The second blow knocked him off his feet. The third blow left no doubt that the fight was done. As Pull arose, his breath already starting to relax, he sensed it. Light, body heat, sweat, eyes on him. From the connecting doorway, he looked. Two small men there, both Latinos, armed, both pointing compact nines right at his head. Two guns could not miss at this distance. The rear guard he had not accounted for. Eight men had come tonight, not six. He had screwed up in an unforgivable way. The penalty for that was crystal clear. He was dead. Chapter 32. It was the first time Puller had seen men fly without benefit of an aircraft, or so it seemed. Their feet left the floor like they were attached to piano wire and someone had just hit a switch, lifting them skyward. The next moment their heads collided. The sound was like a pair of cantaloupes smacking against one another. Puller could see the sensation of the violent collision spread to their eyes and mouths. The eyes winced, rolled in their heads, and then closed. The mouths opened wide. Cries of pain came from them, and then they closed like the eyes. But unlike the eyes, they closed only for a moment. Then they sagged open, even as their bodies became dead weight, and they dropped to the floor. They hit it hard, guns skidding away. Blood pooled from their open mouths where teeth had cut deeply into tongues. Standing behind the two small men was the giant, the man Puller had seen twice before. It seemed that the rear guard had done the unforgivable. They had used the giant's room as their staging area without his permission. That was the only reason Puller could fathom for the man doing what he had done. He straightened and stared at the giant. Puller's M11 twitched in his hand. The giant was unarmed but still looked uncomfortably lethal and completely unafraid as he stood there staring back at Puller. Puller said, "Thanks." The giant said nothing. He glanced once at Puller's sidearm, as though gauging whether this was a threat that needed to be dealt with now. Then he put one enormous boot on the torso of the first man and pushed. The man's body slid into the room Puller was in. A moment later, another push sent the other man sliding into the room. The giant looked at Puller. Puller looked at the giant. "I'll try to keep things more quiet," said Puller. Puller thought he saw a hint of a smile before the giant closed the door to his room. A few moments later, Puller could hear the screech of sagging bed springs. The giant was apparently going to sleep after this minor interruption. Puller holstered his weapon, but pulled it again in an instant, found his target, and prepared to fire. "It's me, it's me." Cheryl Landry held up her gun in a surrender position. Puller slowly lowered his M11 and lifted up his goggles. "Sorry." She gazed around at the mess of humanity that lay sprawled around his room. "Puller, what the hell did you do? There are three more laid out in the hall." "I just take them on as they come," he holstered his gun. "You were smart to call me. Sorry I didn't get here in time. I could have waited, but that was my call. Nothing you could have done." "Why didn't you wait until I got here? My fight. No need for you to get involved, except in the cleanup. Do I translate that as meaning you didn't think I could hold my own? You're a cop, Landry. If we had fought these clowns together, you'd be doing paperwork the rest of your life to explain the whys and hows, and then your career would still be in the toilet. But for that, I could have no problem with you backing me up. And believe me, I don't make such a statement lightly." She seemed both put off and mollified by this statement. She slid her weapon into her belt holster. She was not in uniform. She had on jeans, black soled tennis shoes, and a gray hoodie with a sliver of black T-shirt revealed underneath. He watched as she counted off in her head. "Five here, three in the hall," he interpreted. She looked at him incredulously. "You took out eight guys all by yourself, and they were armed?" Puller's gaze shifted for one millisecond to the sounds of snoring coming from the next room. The giant had dropped off fast, but something told him the man could awaken and kill any attacker within a pair of seconds. He decided it would be much too complicated to bring him into the discussion with Landry. He said, "There were eight stupid guys. Armed has nothing to do with it. If you don't give yourself a chance to use your weapons. You said it was three guys who were attacking the girl earlier." Puller nodded and pointed to white, black, and Latino. These three idiots here, the girl is too scared to press charges, but I'll be glad to. They weren't here to welcome me back to my room, attempted murder at least. He paused, and I doubt they have permits for these guns. You know any of them? Landry pulled a small but powerful light from her hoodie pocket and shined it on each of the fallen men. These two, yeah. They don't belong to any gangs, but I'm aware of, but they've got a rap sheet with us. I heard they were too dumb and unreliable to be of any use to a gang. Where did you hear that from? Confidential source. You've been here a little over 12 hours. Where do you get confidential sources that fast? You work at it. I'm going to call for transport on this. Okay. Paperwork to fill out. I bet. It can wait until morning. Appreciate that. You got another place to stay? Puller thought about this. His aunt's house was an option, but right now he considered it an unprocessed crime scene. His moving in there, even for a night, could potentially foul up some important evidence. He couldn't bring himself to do that, even if it was more convenient for him personally. My car. The vet? No, another set of wheels. Figured the vet was too conspicuous. I'd agree with that. So I can sleep in my vehicle. On the street? Why don't you keep them safe? Puller just beat the crap out of 8 guys who live in paradise. I'm sure all 8 have friends and family who might want a little revenge. They'll be looking for you, whether you're in a car or in another cheap motel. Well, I can rent a blanket and lie out on the beach. You're not getting my point. They could come and kill you. You got any suggestions then? I'm fresh out of ideas. Landry looked uncertain, and then she looked uncomfortable. Her changing features piqued Puller's interest. He wondered what she would say. Look, you can stay at my place just for tonight. You in Paradise? Just next door in Destin. You don't care to live in Paradise? I like the view in Destin better. Besides, it's only 15 minutes away. But it's an important 15 minutes for you. I doubt the friends and family will find you there. You don't have to put me up. I know I don't. I wouldn't have offered if I didn't want to. You don't really know me. I told you my brother's in the army. He checked you out for me. Said there's not an enlisted with a better record in the service. The only knock against you is why you didn't go to West Point. My brother said your father was like Patton and Schwarzkopf rolled into one. I wouldn't agree with that, although he probably rotates closer to Patton, at least in his bedside manner. So you'll stay at my place? Okay, just for tonight. Just for tonight, she repeated, and then slipped her phone out and called for police and medical transport for 8 men who'd had the shit kicked out of them. After she finished and put her phone away, she said, Bullock will want to see you about this. I bet he will. In fact, I've already seen him tonight. Did he bite your head off? I think we've reached an understanding, actually. Okay, but I wouldn't count on that holding after this. Right. You've sort of set a record for mayhem in Paradise. I can see that. You going to be here much longer? Wish I could tell you for sure, but I can't. Your aunt? My aunt. You just don't let go, do you? Never saw the point, replied Puller. Chapter 33. Puller was following Landry over to her place. She was ahead of him in a dark blue, white-topped Toyota FJ 4x4 cruiser. It looked rugged and durable and ready to roll on asphalt or sand, which was probably why she had purchased it. Puller had pegged her as particularly no-nonsense. He also could tell this by her keeping exactly to the speed limit as they headed west to Destin. On the way, he phoned his brother at USDB. The call had been scheduled in advance, as required, and although he was late phoning in, he was put through a few seconds later. Robert Puller had been waiting his younger brother's call and picked up immediately. Sorry for the late call. I got sidetracked. That's okay. I was going to go out tonight, but decided to just stay here and wait for you to ring up. Nice to hear you've retained your sense of humor. Most important thing I've got, actually. Maybe the only thing I've got. I can see that. Now, when you get sidetracked, it usually means someone is lying all bloody in a ditch. They're not in a ditch. They're in a holding cell. Talk to me. Puller conveyed most of what had happened in Paradise over the last 12 hours or so. When he recounted it, he was amazed that he had packed so much into so little time. you've been busy, said Robert. Wasn't really by choice. So a journal is missing from Betsy's house, looks to be, and a 10-mile drive at night. That was just a guess. I'll have to confirm it. And the guys following you? Got a contact at USACIL working on that. Hopefully I'll hear something soon. Sorry you had to see Aunt Betsy like that. How much of the summers we spent with her and Uncle Floyd did you remember? Pretty much every second. She was an unforgettable lady, sort of like the old man, but with compassion and a heart. Puller nodded. That would have been his articulated assessment as well. Some of the best times we ever had, he noted. Sometimes I think we're the way we are because of her more than the old man. I haven't really thought about it, but the older I get, the more I think I'm like the old man too much. Stop thinking that. It'll drive you crazy. Maybe it already has. You're the sanest man I know, and that's saying something. Maybe, Bobby, maybe not. So, what do you think? Was she murdered? Factor in the journal missing, if that's what it was. The folks tailing me, the fact that I think the lawyer is lying to me, and what was in Aunt Betsy's note? Yeah, I think she was murdered. But the police don't see it that way. Not now they don't. That could change. So who's in the holding cells? Just some folks I had a disagreement with, not connected to what I'm down here for. You really can't be sure about that. You're right, I can't be, but it's just my gut. What are your next steps? Get some sleep. I'm running on empty right now. Anything else? Puller hesitated, then decided to say it. There's a guy down here, bigger than me, stronger than me, probably can kick my ass. That qualifies as remarkable. What's the connection to you? Don't know that there is any. Could just be wrong place, wrong time. You could just shoot him. He actually helped me out tonight. I don't think he did it because he was a good Samaritan. I think he was just angry that somebody was disturbing his sleep. Okay, I think I follow that, but not really. How are things on your end? The views haven't changed. Puller cracked a grin, but then it faded. Yeah. So, after you get some sleep, what then? Run the 10 miles Betsy may have done. Work on the lawyer angle. Follow up with USACIL. I'm getting my duffel of goodies tomorrow at Elgin Air Force Base. Then I can start acting like a real investigator again. Sounds like a plan. But watch your back, John. You're there solo, and you don't really know who to trust, and it sounds like you have reason to distrust quite a few people right now. Good advice, Bobby. So how's the house? What? Aunt Betsy's house. How is it? It's nice, near the water. You going to be moving down there now that it's yours? I doubt it. Come on, lots of people move to Florida. Honestly, paradise is turning out to be way too dangerous for my taste. Puller clicked off and kept driving. Chapter 34. Landry's condo was on the 10th floor of a 20-story building a few steps from the beach. Actually, the front yard of the place was the beach. He followed her into a covered parking garage and pulled in close to her vehicle. They got out and he followed her to a bank of elevators, his small duffel containing his clothes slung over his shoulder. Looks like a nice place, he said. I like it. Good mix of folks, young to old. And the beach a few steps away, not a coincidence. I'm into water sports, so what else do you do for fun? The elevator dinged and the doors slid open. Target shooting, catching bad guys. They stepped inside the elevator. Puller asked, are those things mutually exclusive? The doors closed. I hope not. They stepped out on the 10th floor, and he followed her down an interior hall with marble flooring done in a dizzying array of colors. She stopped at condo 1017 and put her key in. They stepped inside and Puller closed the door behind him. I've got a guest bedroom. It's got its own bathroom. Kitchen's over there. Fridge is stocked. I'm not much into cooking, but help yourself. Patio is over there with spectacular views of the Gulf. I've got a laundry room, too, if you need any stuff done. I'm good on that. He went to his room, dropped the duffel on the bed, and came back out. He looked around. The furnishings all looked relatively new and in good taste. He wasn't much into decorating. His apartment back in Quantico was neat and spare, but in all other respects indistinguishable from a college dorm room. He slid open the door to the small patio and stepped out. The breeze was strong up here, and it carried the full weight of the briny smells from the ocean. There was a chaise sling chair, a small charcoal grill, and a round outdoor table stacked with books. Standing up against one wall was a surfboard and an even longer paddleboard with the paddle next to it. Slung over the rail and kept there with clothesline clips were several bikinis. Puller gazed at them for a few moments and then switched his observations to the ocean when Landry stepped out and discreetly collected her bathing suits, carrying them back inside before rejoining him. Puller leaned against the railing and eyed the boards. "So you really are into water sports? Pretty stupid to live here and not be. Are you from Destin?" "Miami. Moved here about 5 years ago." "How come? I understand Miami is a fun place for young people." "It can be for some young people. It just wasn't right for me. Besides, I'd grown up there. I'd seen and done it all, nothing new. And it got to be too crowded, too crazy. The Emerald Coast is a better fit, or the Redneck Riviera, as some call it. And becoming a cop? What I wanted. My father was a detective in Miami. I grew up with cops all around all the time. Liked what I saw, so I joined the ranks in Miami. I think my father thought my brother would follow in his footsteps, too, but the army was his dream." "Your father sorry you left Miami to come here? He probably would be if he were alive. Psycho freaked on PCP took care of that." "I'm sorry, but detectives don't usually go down that way. They come in after the fact. He wasn't detecting. He was a citizen sitting in a bar having a drink when the PCP dude went crazy. My dad tried to stop him. It didn't work. How about your mom? I think I've told you enough about me. Not praying, just making conversation." "No need. I get along just fine with silence." "Me too, actually. I'm beat. I'm hitting the sheets. You're on your own for breakfast. I get up early, do some beach stuff before hitting the gym downstairs. You can join me if you want, then I head to work." "I'll let you get to it then." She left him and he heard her bedroom door close a few minutes later. Puller continued to stare out over the ocean from his high perch. It was like he could see the whole world from up here. All he wanted to see, however, was the truth behind his aunt's death. He heard a shower start running and figured Landry was rinsing off before hitting the sheets. She was one who kept things close to the vest. An interesting person. But then again, Puller had been here a little over 12 hours, and he had met a whole lot of interesting persons. The running water stopped, and he heard the shower door again open. He counted the seconds in his head, giving her time to towel off and go to bed. A few moments after that, he heard her bed squeak slightly. He checked his watch. It was really late. Later, actually, for him, since he'd lost an hour based on his eternal clock. He went back inside. The AC was on, but it somehow felt hotter in here than it had out there. He walked to his room, closed the door, shed his clothes down to his green army boxers, and climbed into bed. The sheets felt cool against his skin. He put his M11 under his pillow in a ritual of his that he figured would keep until his death. Serving all those tours in the Middle East just did that to a guy. Over there, you were never really certain who was your friend and who was your foe. Depending on that day, it would be one or another. And the next day, those roles could reverse. When you were talking about matters of life and death, such confusion was not welcome. His thoughts turned to the giant, a friend thought. But what about tomorrow? There was no reason to believe the man had any connection to why Puller was down here. But Puller knew that could change. When he had been in West Virginia recently, many people had turned out to be not who they claimed to be, and connections that seemed absurd before had turned out to be very much real. He popped his neck, stretched a kink out of his long legs, closed his eyes, and went to sleep. He figured if he dreamt, it would have absolutely nothing to do with being in paradise. He, like Landry, preferred the view from here. Chapter 35. Cheryl Landry stirred at 6 a.m. At 6:10, she was outfitted in board shorts and a bikini top, of which she wore a short-sleeve T-shirt. With flip-flops on her feet and a large beach towel under her arm, she opened the door to her bedroom and saw Puller sitting at the small round table drinking a cup of coffee and reading the morning paper. He was dressed in workout clothes, black shorts, army green T-shirt, and sneakers. He looked up and saw her staring at him. He held up the cup. You want some Java before you hit the water? No thanks, I'm trying to cut down. She walked across to the patio and retrieved her paddleboard. I'm actually thinking of taking up herbal tea instead, said Puller as she stepped back inside. Seriously? Caffeine blows your aim. That's reason enough for the military to ban it, although they never will. It's too ingrained in the DOD's psyche. He held up the paper. Hope you don't mind. It was at the front door. No problem. The only reason I get the paper is that it's free. I read online for the most part. Puller looked down at the first page of the paper. A large photo of the deceased Mr. and Mrs. Storo dominated it. The Storo murders are all over it. I wouldn't put it past some folks in neighboring towns to play that up big just to take tourists away from paradise. Is it that cutthroat down here? When it comes to tourist dollars, it is. Puller rose, rinsed out his cup, and put it in the dishwasher. You coming to the beach? I figure I'll run while you do whatever it is you do with that. It's a paddleboard, she said, seeming surprised he wasn't aware of that. Okay, you stand up and paddle on it. Right, said Puller. Figured something like that. They've been around a while. You don't get to the beach much, I guess. I guess I don't. It's not as easy as it looks. It doesn't look easy to me. I'm not even sure that thing would support my weight. How far do you run? How long do you paddle? About 45 minutes. That's how long I'll run, then. I'm going to work out afterwards in the gym. Okay. You too? Me too. I haven't done much lately. Need to get back into it. You look like you're in great shape. He held the elevator door open for her as she eased the long paddleboard inside the car. Looks can be deceiving. Puller found a swath of hard-packed sand and began his run. He had watched as Landry shed her T-shirt and walked into the water, with her board past the breakers. She lay flat on the board and paddled out farther to where the ocean was calm and flat. She hoisted herself up on the board and began paddling, alternating sides. She paddled parallel to the beach in the same direction Puller was running, so he could keep an eye on her. It was early enough that there weren't many folks out yet. A few older fishermen with their poles mounted in PVC pipe wedged in the sand were talking and sipping coffee from thermoses. An older woman walked along, head down but swinging her arms in elliptical motions as she did so. To Puller, it looked like she was performing some sort of physical therapy. Maybe she'd blown out both rotators. A couple jogged along with a sleek Irish setter, keeping pace. Seagulls soared and dove, looking for breakfast in the green waters. He checked his watch, turned, and headed back the way he had come. He looked out and saw Landry make her turn and do the same thing. Nearly 25 minutes into his run, Puller felt nicely warmed up. His lungs were operating fully, his legs felt juiced, his arms kept plumping. He had run literally thousands of miles training to become an Army Ranger. Special Forces was mostly about weapons, training, and endurance. Yeah, they all pumped weights. Yeah, they were all strong as bears. But it was the stamina that really was the difference between living and dying. At the end of 45 minutes, he stood in the sand at the spot where he had begun, moving his arms and legs, keeping his heart rate up, but allowing his body to cool down slowly. Landry paddled back in, hit the breakers, stood, and worked her way through them before arriving back on the sand. She snagged her T-shirt and towel from the beach and carried her board over to Puller. I need to do a quick change. How was the run? It was a run. They're all the same. You don't look out of breath for having just run all that way. It wasn't that far. How was the paddling? Enlightening. Really? Looking at her skeptically. It gives you time to think. Just you and the paddle and the water. She paused and looked up at him as they walked back to the condo building. Did you do anything while you were running? Now that you mention it, I suppose I did. And I need to do some more thinking. She toweled off before going into the building, and then they rode the elevator up to her condo. She took 5 minutes to rinse the salt water off and change, and came back out in black tights that ended above her knees, a tight T-shirt and a sports bra underneath, and sneakers with ankle socks. Her wet hair was tied back with a green scrunchie. The condo gym was large and efficiently laid out. There were universal machines, free weights, squat racks, dumbbells, a cardio section with treadmills, elliptical machines, stair climbers, and an open floor space where exercise classes were apparently conducted. Landry hit the universal circuit while Puller stretched and then did pull-ups and push-ups, calisthenics, and a lot of leg exercises, pushing his lower body hard. Finished, they toweled off, grabbed some waters from a small fridge next to the exit door, and headed back to the elevator. You do a lot of leg work. Most guys focus on the biceps. I never been able to run on my hands. She laughed. You do this every morning? Asked Puller. Every morning that I can, yeah. Then you'll live forever. She smiled and then became serious. Unless I go down in the line of duty. There's always that. I guess for you, too. She eyed his calf and his forearm where his combat scars were prominent. She pointed to them. Iraq? Afghanistan? Both. My brother's still over there. Hope he comes home soon and safe. He too. Will he come here? Doubtful. He plans to stay in for the full ride. The Army's a good employer. He'll do just fine. But you're a little biased, aren't you? Actually, I'm a lot biased. So what's on your agenda for today? I'm going back to my aunt's house, check some things out. Puller, you heard what Chief Bullock said. That's all worked out. Remember I told you I saw him last night? It was at the house. My aunt left it to me. Legal docs prove it, and the lawyer gave me the key. Oh, hey, that's great. So do you really think her death was more than an accident? Well, I know for sure you'll be... When I know for sure you'll be one of the first people I tell. They got back to the condo, showered and changed. Puller made some fresh coffee, and when Landry came out in her uniform, he poured her a cup. They drank it on the patio, watching the sun continue its rise. The beach below was starting to get more crowded as families jockeyed for the best pieces of sand. You see yourself staying here long-term, he asked. I haven't really thought about it. What about you? I guess you're in for the full ride, too, with Uncle Sam. I guess I am. And after that, you'll still be a young guy. Who knows? You could become a cop. Maybe. You always so loquacious. Compared to other times, I'm being downright gregarious. His phone buzzed. He looked at the readout. It was Christian Craig from USACIL. Hopefully she had an answer on the men following him. Larry looked at the phone. Back to work, she asked, looking a little disappointed. Back to work. Chapter 36. Landry and Fuller parted company as Puller answered the phone. Hey, Christine. But it wasn't Christine. It was a man's voice. Agent John Puller, who wants to know? Colonel Peter Walmsley, that's who, soldier. Yes, sir, said Puller, automatically snapping to attention, even though he was only on the phone. What can I do for you, sir? I want to know why you're calling USACIL to perform work on things unrelated to your duties at CID. That's what I want to damn well know. Do you view the Army's perimeter premier forensics lab as your personal playpen? Puller licked his lips and pondered how to respond to this. Would you be referring to my phone call to Ms. Craig? I would be referring to that, specifically via your request that she run down a license plate number for you, and also why a duffel full of investigative equipment owned by this man's army is on its way to you at Elgin Air Force Base to be used on a matter not involving CID. Oh, I apologize for the misunderstanding, sir. So you're saying it was a misunderstanding? Why don't you explain that one in a way that doesn't make me want to prefer official charges against you, Paula? I observed two men who looked like soldiers following me in Florida, Colonel Walmsley. I requested that Miss Craig attempt to use reasonable means at her disposal to determine if the men were members of the service. The most expeditious way of doing that seemed to be tracking their vehicle. I acquired the license plate information and communicated that to Miss Craig. Why would Army personnel be following you, Puller? If I had the answer to that, sir, I would not have involved Miss Craig. And the duffel? Connected to the same matter, sir. I came down here on a family matter. I didn't bring any equipment with me. If it became necessary for me to initiate an investigation, I wanted to be properly outfitted to do so. When exactly were you going to inform your superior officer of all this? Once I determined that I had something to report. That involved other military members, but I want to make it clear that I accept full responsibility for this. Ms. Craig was under the impression that I was engaged in authorized work. None of this should reflect on her record, sir. You cover for your friends well, Puller, I'll give you that. But for your information, Ms. Craig has been relieved of duty pending completion of an inquiry on this matter. Oh, no, thought Puller. I'm sorry to hear that, sir. Not as sorry as she was. Now let's talk about you. Yes, sir. I understand from CID that you're on authorized leave right now. Yes, sir. And that you successfully carried out a commission in West Virginia that saved this country an enormous headache. Puller said nothing. So I'm basically being told that you need to get a pass on this. I don't like that one bit, Puller. Every soldier should be held to the same standard. Don't you agree? Yes, I do, sir. And what is that standard? Puller thought he was on back in boot camp. The highest possible standard, sir, he replied automatically. But that apparently is not how it's going down in this case. Sounds like baloney to me, Puller. Yes, sir, it does. But you can man up and do something about it. Get your ass up here and take the heat. Puller admired the skill with which the colonel had maneuvered him into a corner. Sir, I would be glad to do that as soon as I have completed my task down here. What the hell task is that? My aunt. Your aunt? What is going on with your aunt? That's what I'm trying to find out, sir. Can't you ask her? I would, sir, but somebody killed her. Somebody killed your aunt? Is that why you want your duffel? Is your aunt in the army? No, sir. Then I'm apparently not getting through to you, Puller. What you're planning to do is an unauthorized... It was at this moment that Puller ran out of patience. It was contrary to his nature to speak with a superior officer. But perhaps his brief time away from the army had dulled those professional instincts. He would just assume that was the case. Sir, if I may elaborate, my aunt sent my father a letter at the VA hospital where he's currently staying. The letter stated she was afraid that things were happening down here that she thought was suspicious. My father asked me to investigate. I came here to do so. I found my aunt dead. Naturally, my suspicions were aroused. When Walmsley next spoke, his tone was far less confrontational. Your father at the VA hospital? Yes, sir. He's not that well, but he's hanging in there, even though sometimes he thinks he's still commanding the 101st. There was a long stretch of silence, and then Walmsley said, Fighting John Puller is your father? Yes, sir. I'm John Puller, Jr. That was not included in my briefing on this. I can't imagine why the hell not. Puller could see a certain aid to Colonel Walmsley getting his or her ass reamed over that one. But my father, being who he is, should not impact this matter at all. No, it shouldn't. It's just that my aunt was my father's only sibling. He took it hard. He was her younger brother. You have siblings, sir? Two older sisters, special relationship, big sisters and little brothers. Yes, sir, so I've heard. There was another pause. Why don't you carry on down there, and we'll revisit this issue later, Agent Puller. Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. And Miss Craig, don't worry about her. I'll take you at your word that she wasn't involved in anything that was unauthorized. She'll be back on duty today. Appreciate it, sir. You tell your father I said hello and convey my best wishes for a speedy recovery. I will do that, Colonel. Thank you. Any chance on running that license plate down, sir? But the line went dead. Didn't look like the army was going to be much help with this. Puller headed to the Tahoe. He needed to get his investigation duffel. Chapter 37. The sweat trickled down his neck. At 8 in the morning, he'd already been hard at work for an hour. It was 82 degrees with a projected high of nearly 100 today. He was at the same house. He had been told that the grounds were so extensive that they required a landscaping crew every day. He had taken steps to make sure that he would get the assignment. It involved payments and promises to people who didn't give a damn why he wanted to be here. For them, it was just an exchange of something for something else. And when you were dealing with folks who had little money, bartering became a way of life. For all they knew, he was trying to case the mansion in hopes of robbing it. They did not care about folks stealing from the rich. The rich had everything. They would just print more money. He was simply one man working for others. He was paid a wage that could barely keep them alive, and he was one injury away from being homeless. As he looked around at the workers next to him, he was actually describing their state of affairs, not his. Money meant nothing to him. He was here for his own purposes and no others. When he was done, he would leave, unless he was dead. Then he would stay in paradise for eternity. He rubbed the sweat from his eyes and commenced clipping a hedge for owners who demanded a precisely trimmed bush, but he also focused on what he had seen the previous night on the beach. Those people were lost forever. As soon as they had been taken, it was over. On the boat, on the truck, it didn't matter. Nothing could break the long chain of ownership, for that's what it was, chattel. The 16th century or 21st century, it didn't really matter. People with power and means would always take advantage of those without them. He clipped and thought about his next move. He ran his eye along the top of the hedge and at the same time skirted his gaze along the perimeter of the mansion. The same Maserati was parked in the first front cobblestone circular drive. He assumed that the young couple had stayed over. Why leave this place if one didn't have to? He had learned by asking subtle questions of a house servant who had come out to retrieve the mail that the interior staff consisted of 10 people. These included maids, a chef, someone playing the role of a butler, and various others who worked cheap and were able to live in the servants' quarters of the grandest home on the Emerald Coast. The people who lived here consisted of 4 people. The cash machine husband, the pampered second wife, the even more pampered son, the mother-in-law. The cash machine was in his mid-40s, relatively young for having amassed such great wealth. He had not been asked the maid how the money had been made. He already knew. The second wife used to be a runaway model, was in her early 30s and spent most of her time shopping. The cash machine's son, the second wife's stepson, was 17 and attended a private boarding school in Connecticut. He had already been accepted at an Ivy League school based more on his father's largesse to the university than his academic performance. He was now home for the summer playing polo, driving his Porsche and sowing his wild oats among the available local young women who were unabashedly competing to one day live in grand houses filled with servants. This he had also found out before coming here. The second wife's mother lived in the lavish green guest house and was, at least by most accounts, a bitch of massive proportions. As he watched, the same woman he had seen by the pool the day before strolled out of the mansion's rear French doors. She had on a white skirt that showed off her bare tan legs, a light blue shirt, and spiked backless heels. Her hair fell around her shoulders. Her appearance was quite dressy for this early in the morning. Perhaps she had an appointment. He watched as she crossed over to the guest house and went inside, perhaps to pay her respects to the resident mother-in-law. The rear door to the mansion opened, and once more, and a man stepped out. He studied him, about 5'11", trim, fit, dressed in white shorts that showed off his tan muscular calves. He had on leather loafers that looked expensive and no doubt were, and a pale blue patent long-sleeved Badachi shirt. He had left the shirt untucked, no doubt to show that despite his immense wealth, he was a casual yet hip man. His hair was brown and wavy with just a touch of gray around the temples. The man crossed the grounds and entered the guest house. He knew who the man was. He was the cash machine. The man owned his estate and everything in it. His name was Peter J. Lambert. He'd made and lost most of a multi-billion-dollar fortune as a hedge fund manager, along with most of the money entrusted to him by his clients. Then he had made another enormous fortune to pay for this place and other assorted toys of the rich, but he had not bothered to recoup his clients' money. That was what bankruptcy was for, he'd responded when someone asked him if he felt remorse at all for destroying the lives of so many people. Lambert, he knew, also had his own private jet. Its maximum cabin height was 6'2", which meant Lambert could stand up straight inside it, but he couldn't. Yet he never expected to be on it. Private jets were not meant for the hired help. At the end of the estate's main dock, 100 feet out to the sea in deep water, sat Lambert's mega yacht named Lady Lucky. Lambert had named that after his second wife, whose name was Lucille. But whom everyone called Lucky because she apparently had been it, as the second wife of Peter J. Lambert. Lucky was currently away, he had been told by the same maid, a shopping trip to Paris and London. Well, the rich had to spend their money on something. As he thought about it, it was quite likely that her mother was traveling with her, too. If so, there would be no reason for anyone to visit the guest house, except perhaps for one. He worked his way over to the left side of the structure. There were bushes there that required trimming. He managed to look like he was clipping, but actually made no noise with his tool. He edged closer to the window. The drapes were partially up. He heard it before he saw them, moans and groans. He looked around for security. They did not seem to be in this sector. He grew closer to the window, squatting down, trying to shrink his great height. He took a peek through the window. The woman was now wearing only her shirt. Her skirt was on the bed along with her spike heels. Her panties were down around her bare feet. On her tiptoes, she gripped one of the bed's four posters. Lambert was behind her. He had not bothered to take off his clothes. Lambert pushed into her violently. Lambert said something that he couldn't hear, but the woman laughed. A few moments later, Lambert was gone. He apparently had other appointments. He watched as the woman lay back on the bed, slipped a pill from her shirt pocket, tongued a capsule, and swallowed it. She took off her shirt, walked naked into the bathroom, and emerged about a minute later, her face looking scrubbed. He continued observing as she quickly dressed, smoothing out her shirt and zipping up her skirt before slipping on her heels. When she left the room, he came around the corner of the building, stooped down, and started to weed the lawn. She stepped from the guest house, looked to the right, and saw him there. "Hello," she said. "You were here yesterday. What's your name?" "Mako." "Mako, I've never heard that name before. In my country it means bear. I am as big as one, you see. I was a big baby, you see, so my father decided to make it official." His English was much better than that, and he was not by nature a shy man, but he did not want her to know that. Mako was not his given name, but it had been his nickname, precisely because of his great size. "What is your country?" "Far away from here, but I like this place. My country is often too cold." "It's always been warm in paradise." "Hey!" They both looked over to see a burly security guard heading their way. Mako hastily stood and moved away from her. "Hey!" the guard said again. "You're really trying my patience, bud." "I was talking to him," the woman said. "He was doing his work. I asked him a question." The guard looked at her like she was on drugs. "You asked him a question? Why?" "Because I wanted to hear his answer." The man was about to say something, but seemed to think better of it. "Right, Ms. Murdoch. I was just making sure everything was okay, just doing my job. Everything is okay. My name is Christina Mako. My friends call me Chrissy. It was nice talking to you." As she walked away, he watched her. She glanced back and saw him. In that knowing smile, he saw something interesting. He was almost certain that he had been watching Lambert and her have sex, and she didn't seem concerned by it in the least. In fact, she seemed uplifted by it. A singly remarkable woman of great beauty, a part of him hoped he would not have to kill her. This concludes the fifth episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Your reader has been Chris Long.